Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley and Kepler's Bookstore. My name is Hazen Jihu and I will be your host for tonight. It's my pleasure to introduce Mike Farrell, actor, political and social activist, and author of Mule and Man. As one of Hollywood's most prominent actors, Mr. Farrell is best known for 8 years on the series MASH as Captain P.J. Honeycutt, and for 5 seasons as Dr. Jim Hansen on Providence. As a fierce opponent to the death penalty policy, Mr. Farrell has been president of the death penalty focus for more than 10 years. His humanitarian work includes serving on the rights and peace delegations to many countries around the world, and since 1979 has been the spokesperson for Concern America, an international refugee aid and development organization. Mr. Farrell serves on the committee of the Human Rights Watch for California, where he was previously co-chair, and after visiting Somalia and Bosnia, was named Goodwill Ambassador of the United Nations High Commission of Refugees. To top it off, last year, the Los Angeles Times named Mike Person of the Year. Our moderator for this evening is Brian Copeland, radio host and author of Not a Genuine Black Man. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mike Farrell and Brian Copeland.
Lovely reception. Thank you very much.
Yes.
You're 2 miles away from me, Mike. Yes. Well, let me start by saying you're an absolute genius, because who else could think of writing a book about promoting another book?
You see, we always think about ways to mention the first book.
So how exactly did this entire enterprise come about? Because it's not your traditional book tour. You know, what made you decide to drive the country as opposed to hopping in a plane, having an escort pick you up and take you to the events like other authors do?
Yes, as other authors do, if from other publishing companies.
Say no more.
Yeah. Akashic Books is a small company that operates out of Brooklyn, New York, and they do not have the kind of budget that allows for the sort of treatment that you're describing. So they asked me, when the book was finally published, if I would consider, if they rented me a car, driving. And I said, are you kidding? My wife and I love driving trips. We take road trips all the time. It was our honeymoon, and it's what we try to do once a year in memory of that. So when the book was first came out in the hardcover, we drove up and down the West Coast, and then they actually put out the money to fly us to the East Coast and rented another car, and we drove on down the East Coast and somewhat into the Midwest. So when the book came out in paperback, this is the other book.
Right. Call Me Mike. We should mention the title of the other book.
Thank
we should
you very play much. When it came out in paperback, the publisher called me and he said, so you really enjoyed that driving experience? And I said, oh, we had a great time. And he said, well, you missed a lot of cities. I said, yeah. And he said, would you consider driving literally across the country, up the East Coast, back across the country, and down the West Coast? And stopping at some places in the Midwest in between. And I said, I think that would be fabulous. It would be a wonderful thing to do. So they laid out this. But I did say, you know, this is a year ago. Gasoline was $4 a gallon. I said, do you really ought to, if you're going to do that, you ought to consider renting us a hybrid. Which he said, no problem. So they laid out this extraordinary itinerary, literally crossing, I think it's 19 states, 25 cities in 19 states, or 19 cities in 25 states, or something like that.
In 31 days.
In 31 days.
That's insanity.
Almost 9,000 miles in 31 days. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I hear the groans in the audience. but it's one of those things that I thought would just be fun. And I will say that, most of the stops on the current tour, every stop along the way was co-sponsored by one of the social justice organizations I have worked with over time. And I got an opportunity to see people I'd worked with or meet people that are associated with some of the work I've done, all of which was great. However, once everything, all was arranged, my son was to be married in our backyard a week before we'd leave. So the week before that, my wife was out hosing down the house to make it look more presentable for the guests at the wedding. And she slipped in some water and fell and broke her hip. My sentiments exactly. And so, of course, the trip was off. I had a sort of grin and talked to the publisher and say, I'm sorry. And they were very understanding. But Shelley, my wife, said, are you nuts? You've got this itinerary laid out. You've got dozens of places that are committed to your being there. You've got dozens of organizations that are already committed to being there and to co-sponsor it. Get the hell out of town. So I laughed, and she said, our daughter's going to be here. She can take care of me. I'm going to be doing physical therapy, and I'll be doing those things, and you need to go. So I took off, and here we are.
Rented a Prius at Hertz, and off you go.
Yeah.
Now, you named the Prius Mule.
I did.
For those who have not read the book, why don't you explain why you picked that particular name? Because, it's usually cars you name, girls' names. Why Mule?
Well, I don't know how many in the audience have driven a hybrid, or particularly a Prius. It was new to me. I drive a pickup truck. I drive a four-on-the-floor stick-shift car. I've been a macho kind of driver for years, I like shifting that car and hitting that clutch and hitting that gas and doing all that stuff. So I went down to the rental place, and they put me in this car, and they handed me this big hunk of plastic and said, this is the key. And I said, it doesn't look like any key I've ever seen before. And so you stick it in this hole, and then there's a button that you push, and I pushed the button. I called the guy. I said, I'm sorry, I can't make this thing work. Can you show me how? So he said, yeah, you put the key in the... I said, I did that. And he said, and there's a power button. And I said, I did that. And he said, whoa, first you have to step on the brake. I said, step on the brake before you hit the power button. He said, yeah. So I stepped on the brake, hit the power button, and I said, see, nothing's happening. It's not running. And he said, oh, yes, it is. And then once I realized that this thing was very silent, I thought, well, okay, now how do I get it to go? And there's this little tiny sort of toggle switch. I'm used to this gear shift, tiny toggle switch on the dashboard. And he said, up is back and down, flick it down is go forward. But you have to step on the brake first. I said, okay. And so it was a learning process from the very beginning. And about the second day, after it had beeped and honked and squeaked at me and told me things that I was doing wrong and things were read out on there's this readout on the dashboard that is supposedly telling me how the car is running, and I can't make head or tail out of it. And whenever I shift into reverse, suddenly it becomes a picture of what's behind me. I was utterly confused. And at one point, it started beeping at me, and I thought the car was going to explode. I was sure there was a bomb coming, and it turned out I'd had the audacity to stop at a health food store, buy some groceries, and set them on the passenger seat and not have thought to hook the seatbelt. So I said to this car, I said, you are a hybrid, and you are a cantankerous son of a bee. Mules are hybrids, and mules are cantankerous. You are the mule. So from then on, it was about a trip with me and the mule.
Now, you, in the book, you use personification in terms of this car. I mean, you have conversations with this car,
indeed.
And the car talks back.
Absolutely.
Dr. Sidney would have had a lot of fun with that on MASH, when I think about it. But the car, I'm real surprised at the end. I expected you just to go on buying the darn thing.
Well, if it hadn't been a car that was owned by the Hertz company and they were not interested in selling, I would have. I would have taken it home and put it in my garage. And when I get the pickup truck I told you about, I've had since 1992. So when it falls dead, I'm going to go down there and find Mule, get her out of the corral, and saddle her up again.
All right, let's talk about the trip some. As you said, all of your events were sponsored by various humanitarian organizations that you work with: Death Penalty Focus, Greenpeace, a lot of these groups.
Yeah.
What's interesting is when you are described in the press a lot, you were described as being Hollywood liberal, Mike Farrell. Now,
yeah.
Since the right has been so successful in making the word liberal a pejorative, does that bother you?
Only the Hollywood part. No, and let me tell you, I mentioned in the book that I was very frustrated by among other things, by the fact that once I got into the middle of the country, when I turned on Mule's radio, all I could hear were Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Dennis Prager and their ilk.
That was my next question. Why did you do that to yourself?
Well, part of it was for entertainment, and part of it was because I needed to exercise my lungs. But an interesting thing happened. A month or a month and a half ago, I was in New York, and the book was just freshly printed, and Sean wanted me to be on his show. I've been on his show a number of times. We've always debated about the war in Iraq or about the death penalty or about any number of other things about which we have serious disagreements. And he said two things. First, he said, Mike, I want you to know that we've debated this over time, and you have finally convinced me that you are right. I now oppose the use of the death penalty.
Wow.
Is that not amazing?
Wow.
Thank you. I was stunned and thrilled, and I said, God bless you, Sean. You are an opinion molder for a lot of people, and it's important to hear you say that on the air. And he did, and he has not backtracked a bit. Number two, he said, did you write about me in the book? And I said, as a matter of fact, I did. I told him about the fact that I was made nuts by him out in the prairie. And I said, you know, one of the things was you and Rush talk about the fact that there is no such thing as global warming. And he said, well, there isn't. And I said, Sean, you know, the body of scientific opinion is against you on this, and I know it's never made any difference to you before, but you really ought to take a look at that. And he still is stuck on that position. And the second was, I said, you identify on your radio show when people call you, you're a great American.
Yes.
Seth, you're a great American. Sean, you're a great American. John, you're a great. And I said, the implication is that anybody who agrees with you politically is a great American, and the extension of that implication is anybody who disagrees with you is not a great American. And he said, you know what? You and I have disagreed for many years over many subjects, and I consider you a great American, even though you're wrong about everything. So again, I thought, that's an important thing for his audience to hear.
It's a big step. Yeah. Well, one of the things that you write about is that in these parts of the Midwest where the only voice you hear is the conservative voices of the Pragers and the Hannitys and the Limbaughs, that their biggest fear is equal time. Now, driving down here this evening, I heard that the Republicans are just furious that Obama is basically taking over ABC for a night in order to tout his health plan. And they are demanding equal time. Any comment?
I love it. Yes, the great awful thing in the sky from these guys' point of view is the return of the equal time provision. Because, as we know, they now dominate the airwaves and they get to spew this garbage all the time without anybody giving them any response. It's very funny and sort of ironic that they're now demanding equal time of the president. I hope he gets the message.
I asked you this before because you wrote in the first book about how excited you were growing up as an Irish Catholic when John Kennedy was running for president when
Indeed.
He got elected. And I asked you if you thought Obama was Kennedy because of the excitement.
Well, there's certainly comparisons. I think realistic comparisons to the phenomenon that is the Obama presidency and the phenomenon that was the Kennedy presidency. And unfortunately, I'm beginning to think there are some comparisons to the fact that Kennedy wasn't quite the liberal we thought him to be.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you that, as a matter of fact. Max, are you disappointed at all? There have been a number of positions that his administration has taken recently where they have used the Bush rationale, things such as, well, you're friends with Joe Wilson and with Valerie Plame.
Yeah.
And one of the positions his administration has taken is to continue to try to block the release of those transcripts from the interviews that Bush and Cheney gave behind closed doors in regard to what they knew and when they knew it.
Yeah, I find that very disappointing. I'm a huge supporter of Senator Obama. I think he's done extraordinary things, and I think he will do extraordinary things. And I think he's wrong in not releasing the photographs, the recent decision he made about releasing the photographs of torture. I think he's wrong about not prosecuting the torturers. I think he's wrong in this instance about continuing this state secrets privilege that suggests that certain things are simply beyond the pale and we cannot allow this information to get out because it somehow hurts national security. I hope he rethinks those positions because I think they're just simply wrongheaded.
Okay, now as I mentioned, you write about Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson in the book, and recently, I guess it was last week, their lawsuit against the Bush administration was the lower federal court had dismissed it, and the Supreme Court refused to review it, so it's essentially dead.
It apparently is. I haven't spoken to Valerie and Joe since I was there, but I got an email from Joe a while back, and I think they're going to still try to find ways to revive some aspect of this, but I just don't know how it can be done. They did that in association with the Center for Ethics and there's an acronym for it, but anyway, it's a Washington organization about ethics and public policy, and it's disturbing to think that these kinds of things cannot be carried forward because somehow they attack the privilege of the people in the White House.
Now, another Supreme Court decision that when I read about it, you were the first person I thought of, being someone who has devoted so many years to trying to abolish the death penalty in this country, and that is last week the Supreme Court ruled that if you are a prisoner, you do not have a constitutional right to DNA evidence, even if you pay for it yourself. And there are three states that don't allow it, and that's Alaska, Massachusetts, and I think Oklahoma. Yeah. So there are a lot of innocent people potentially that are going to stay in prison for that, right?
What they've essentially said is that it's not a federal issue and that the federal government should not impose their view on the states. And this is, the old states' rights privilege, essentially, and that's the view of the right wing. And I was really surprised that they apparently got Justice Breyer to come over on that one. But it's a hideous thing. It's a hideous thing that suggests that a person who claims that his innocence can be proven by a DNA test, in this case with Mr. Osborne in Alaska, it's a rape case, rape murder, and he says he didn't do it, and he says a DNA test will prove it, and Alaska will not allow him to do this, even if he pays for it himself. It's been challenged in court. It's gone to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court continued the position that Alaska has the right to not allow him to have a DNA test that could prove himself innocent. I mean, it's astonishing to have the court make a determination like that, because the man is taking the risk, of course, that the DNA test would say just the reverse.
Well, prosecutors have even said that it will prove conclusively that he did it, but we don't want him to take it.
Yeah. No, go believe that. I'm aghast at that decision on the part of this court, but I'm not unfortunately surprised.
You're not surprised. Well, Roberts, majority, he writing for the majority, said that a conviction that's obtained fair and square should not be revisited because of new technology. That's what he said.
That's
if
exactly
we get it fair and square,
you
know, we got you fair and square. That's it. It's over. It's closed.
Yep. It's a little like saying, and as the many courts do, if we find out conclusively that you're innocent after you've been proven guilty, we don't want to hear about it.
Have you ever, since you've been working with Death Penalty Focus, had to deal with angry family members of murder victims?
Oh, sure, sure.
What kinds of things and how do they say to you and how do you deal with them?
Well, the whole issue of family members is a very difficult one for anybody, but we have family members on our board of directors, family members of murder victims, and we work in association with the murder victims' families for reconciliation and murder victims' families for human rights, both of which oppose the use of the death penalty. But there are some people who are just so deeply damaged and injured by the murder of a loved one that they simply cannot see beyond the need, as they feel it, for revenge. And one has to understand and honor that. So I don't try to tell them they're wrong. That would be the last thing in the world. And I have to say that I understand your position. I don't support your position, but God knows I understand it, and I'm sorry that you suffered the way you have. But we in our society can't make a public policy decision based on the emotional needs of an individual at a certain moment. We don't rape rapists. We don't burn down the homes of arsonists. Why should we be put in the position as a society of stooping to the level of the lowest member of our community at his or her worst moment and reach out and kill a helpless, shackled, caged human being in order somehow to make the balance the scales? And I think people find over time that there is, one, the automatic emotional desire for revenge. God, if my wife or daughter were right. raped and murdered, I'd want to strangle the bastard with my bare hands. Of course I would. I hope I wouldn't. But what I would not want is the country to make the determination that based on my anger and fear and rage, they have to then take the next step and eliminate the individual who did that.
Without... It's not politically correct to say that, especially if you're a politician. In fact, you write about this governor. I'm trying to remember what state it is who they were going to abolish the death penalty in that state, and the governor didn't want to sign it because he had presidential, vice presidential aspirations.
Oh, that was Bill Richardson, who governor this Richardson. Year just did it, finally. He just, 2 months ago, the New Mexico has done away with the death penalty.
Once the election was over.
Once the election was over, yeah, yeah. But it's mostly a function of political cowardice most of the time. I mean, we just saw it in Connecticut. Both houses of the state legislature passed a bill to repeal the death penalty in Connecticut, and the governor vetoed it. It seems to me when the elected representatives of your state, of your constituency, your polity, make a determination that you ought to take very seriously their decision, but not for Governor Rill.
Well, there's that whole soft on crime fear.
Well, exactly. And that's when I said political cowardice. That's really what it's about. People are afraid you'll be labeled as soft on crime if you're publicly opposed to the use of the death penalty without an understanding that life in prison without possibility of parole is a very, very harsh punishment. We have a case in California, a week ago, a man on death row in San Quentin committed suicide. We have more suicides and more people dying of old age on death row in San Quentin than we have people being executed.
We have some questions folks in the audience have sent up. Let's see. Let's start with this one. Obama's come in office with a new perspective on the role of the U.S. in the world and in our own backyard. For example, his emphasis on community involvement and volunteerism. What are your expectations of this administration in the areas of human rights and the environment?
Well, my expectations exceed the performance so far, but I think President Obama is right on the money and very clear about the environmental concern, about climate change, and about things that are going to have to be done. And there's a bill coming forward in the House of Representatives, and there's a separate one coming forward in the Senate that are very good, and I think he's very supportive of them, and I think that's appropriate. But there are big business interests that are going to oppose it, and we're going to hear all about the cost to us of these attempts to save our environment and save ourselves, given what's happening in the climatic world. In terms of human rights, I believe he's making some positive steps. He's going to close Guantanamo. He's going to open up communications with other parts of the world. He's going to recognize our legitimate positions and, I think, articulate a view that is consistent with our principles, unlike some people who have been in that office. But, unfortunately, he's not going far enough, in my view, which is that he needs to be willing to understand that there's a legal precedent that's being violated by his position about torturers. He's effectively saying we have to look forward, not back. That's a clever way to say we're not going to do what's necessary with regard to the people who are responsible for all the torture that was illegal and was done under the aegis of the prior administration.
Okay, but what about the argument that some make that we have an almost unprecedented financial disaster in this country right now. We're dealing with two wars that rather than have the Congress tied up investigating and holding hearings on the prior administration, they should be dealing with putting out the fire now, the fire that we're dealing with right now with Afghanistan, with Iraq, with apparently a nuclear North Korea, with what's happening in Iran, as opposed to looking backwards and trying to punish the a previous administration, which is unprecedented.
It is. And first of all, I don't think the argument that says you can't do more than one thing at the same time holds water.
This is Congress.
Point taken. But second, I think, you know, you have committees of Congress, and committees of Congress that are focused on, as, for example, is the case today, there are committees of Congress focused on health care reform, there are committees of Congress focused on the climate. There's nothing to say we couldn't have, at a minimum, a commission, a truth commission, that isn't engaged in prosecuting, but is engaged in getting to the bottom of what happened and finding out whether or not laws were broken. Because it's very important, it seems to me, as a law-abiding society, for us to not disregard the fact that laws may have been broken on the basis of the fact that it's either unprecedented to look back at a prior administration or that it's somehow politically inconvenient. Because effectively that's saying, well, I know you did that murder last week, but let's not worry about that because we've got to look forward. You know, all the people who are on trial could arguably say, what are you doing to me here?
Let's not talk about the past.
Yeah.
That robbery, that's in the past.
That's right. The past is past. Let's move on, you know. So I really don't think that that's for me, it's not a satisfactory argument. And the other is we have an obligation, I think, as a nation that abides by and believes in the rule of law, to at least look and inform the American people and inform the people of the world that we care about whether or not laws are meaningful. Mm-hmm. And if we care about whether or not laws are meaningful, we have to look at it and we have to make a clear record about it. And even if we don't prosecute these people, and I believe we should, even if we don't prosecute them, let's at least say the laws were broken, and they were broken by John Yoo and all of these creeps that were there making this terrible act of torture under the pretense of the color of law acceptable. I think it attacked and damaged the fabric of this nation in a way that we haven't yet fully understood.
Okay, a diversion. Did you have to take a crash course in medical lingo and procedures to do MASH?
During MASH. I thought maybe there was another time that it... No, there was no crash course. I had... In 1971, I did a show called The Interns with Broderick Crawford, where I did my internship. and in 1973, I did a picture where I played a doctor. And in 1974, I did a pilot for a series with Jane Wyman, in which I played James Brolin to her, to her Dr. Welby, where I was a young doctor, a resident, and I figured between those three things that I was ready to go when MASH started. But a better answer is that
I've been having this pain in my side. I was wondering if you could look at it after we're done.
A better answer is that we had a surgical nurse on the set who could show us the proper procedures, and we had a doctor on call at all times who was on the set a lot, explaining to us what the procedures were, what the lingo was. The script writers were very, very good about that, and they didn't let us do things incorrectly.
Question of my own. David Ogden Stiers came out in the last month or so publicly that he was gay. Do you think that that would have been a problem back in, if he'd done it in 1980, 1981 at the height of MASH? Do you think that the network would have frowned upon it? Do you think sponsors, that there would have been an issue?
I can't answer that, Brian. I don't think so. But I don't know. We were very strongly active, we, the cast, in opposition to the Proposition 6 in 1976, which was a I'm sure California residents remember, Senator John Briggs tried to get an initiative passed that would have barred homosexuals from teaching in our schools because somehow they were considered to be dangerous to our children. But it's, you know, it's that all that old nonsense that has been passed around about gay people over time. You know, David chose to stay closeted for a long time and then finally came out, and God bless him. I have no problem with it. I can't imagine anybody in the crew or cast would have had a problem with it. And I can't really, well, I tell you, the show was so popular and his character was so popular, there's not a chance that the network would have objected publicly at all.
That show would never get on the air today.
That's right. It would not get on the air today. Not a chance. It's too taking chances politically or something that the networks, which are losing their audience by, in droves, are simply not willing and not somehow constitutionally able to do, which is really silly when you look at the fact that the shows that are taking their audiences away are all the sort of chance-taking shows on the cable networks.
Let's see. In your travels, what have you found out about why so many Americans continue to believe in the death penalty?
Well, most Americans who believe in the death penalty, and I don't mean to disparage them, are misinformed. Most think that it's a deterrent. And there was just a recent study done by criminologists across the country that demonstrates that there is no deterrent quality to the death penalty. A significant number of Americans think it's cheaper to kill people than it is to keep them in prison for the rest of their natural lives, which is also not true. And that study is those studies, I should say, have become more appropriately out in the world. A lot of people believe that this biblical admonition that, you know, an eye for an eye means if somebody kills, you should kill that person. And I think even the rabbinical scholars have suggested that that's not the case. But it's kind of easy on one level. And there's been an American tradition for many years to hang the horse thieves and lynch people that they didn't like or feared. So some people are just, I think, not particularly aware of the reality of the system that we have. And that's the point I try to make when I debate this. I say, look, it's not because I believe killing is wrong. It doesn't mean that I think that you, who believe the state has the right to take a life under certain circumstances, have somehow a lower sense of morality than I do. But my point is just that if you want to be fair, and I believe all of us want to be fair, then you have to look at the system and understand that it's racist at its core. It is only used against the poor, almost virtually always only used against the poor. That it's full of mistakes that are made, some not just mistakes, but some intentional errors on the part of prosecutors and police. And that we're convicting and executing innocent people. We have 133 people who have gone through the process and have been thankfully discovered to be innocent and released from death row, but we don't know how many have actually been killed who have been innocent. So those are the things that I think have to be addressed. And ultimately, as we begin to address those things, even prosecutors are telling me, if it wasn't the law of the land and it wasn't required, I wouldn't do it.
They wouldn't pursue it.
Yeah. And this, as you know, the district attorney of San Francisco said, I oppose the use of the death penalty, and I won't do
Kamala
it. And
Harris.
She hasn't, right?
And she's taken a lot of flack
taken
from that,
a lot of flack,
especially when a police officer was killed.
Yes, that's right.
A lot of flack. A follow-up to that question about your travels, were there any, let's put it this way, what was the biggest preconceived notion that perhaps you had about a certain segment of the country, maybe the South or the Midwest that you went through, that was perhaps changed by visiting that region and talking to the people, or were there any?
Well, you know, I, like everybody else, fell into this jargon about red states and blue states, and I found that there aren't any red states and blue states. That's a creature of the political machinery and the media. You know, there are people in every city, in every area that I stopped in who were very thoughtful, very giving, very generous, very community-spirited, some of whom disagree with me on issues, and we discuss those issues, but all of whom were capable of respectfully disagreeing. And that's great. That's what, you know, that's what education and community is about. So the great thing I learned, I think, is that this is a big, beautiful, generous, warm, fabulous country with a lot of good people in it. And they don't want to be divided up by red and blue. They don't want to be divided up by issues. They want to be a community.
I'll tell you what I found charming was that you wrote actually a number of times is how surprised you were that people came out. that there were so many, that the crowds were so large in the places that you went, where you expected there to be nobody and the place was packed.
You know, I must say, it's always thrilling to me when people actually show up. There's that actor's fear, you know, the one that you're going to be, the dreams are that you're there on stage naked, or that you're there on stage and you've forgotten what the play is, or the third is you're there on stage ready to go and there's nobody in the house. And it's always a wonderful thing to come out and have people there who are interested in being there.
Here's another question from the audience. You recently spoke out in favor of Medicare for All. Do you believe health care is a fundamental human right, and do you think Obama will be able to get a bill passed that will give coverage to the millions of uninsured Americans?
Yes, I believe health care is a human right. I think their business community should really not have a part in it. I believe health care for all, or Medicare for all, is really the answer. And I believe that... Thank you. And I believe that at a minimum, the president is on record as saying that a public option, which is the beginning of health care for all, must be part of the new health care proposal. And I hope he holds to that. There is a lot of pressure being put on him to disagree with that position or to give it up. But I think it's urgently necessary. Now, what the business community fears, the medical insurance community fears, is that if the public option is there and people find it that it's there and it's cheaper and they get very good health care that way, there's going to be what Ross Perot called that giant sucking sound. Everybody's going to leave their health insurance company and go into the public system. And I frankly like to see that happen.
Okay, now to play devil's advocate, what about the argument that we can't afford it, that the price tag he put on it was $1 trillion, but in actuality it's going to be at least twice that?
Yeah. Well, in fact, we can well afford it. And what we can't afford to do is have a system that in which 50 million people don't have health insurance coverage. It would have to be paid for by taxes. It would have to be paid for in the way that it is paid for in other countries that have highly successful health care delivery systems. But what we're finding, if you look at it, the cost of health care in this country today is the highest in the world, and we are missing a significant portion of our population. And if you do the math, you will find that it would be cheaper, significantly cheaper, to have health care under a Medicare for All system, simply because you lose the 30% of the costs that are going to paperwork and executive salaries and bonuses and all of the falderal that's
attached. All the bureaucracy.
Exactly, that's attached as a result of business having stuck its head in there where it doesn't belong. Sean Hannity and I discussed that too, and he said, "You mean you're opposed to the capitalist system, the free market system?" I said, "I'm opposed to it in the medical delivery system, yeah. Doesn't belong there."
I read that Alan Alda always called you the communist.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. He meant it affectionately, though.
Okay, comrade. Here's another question from the audience. The struggle for human rights is one of your primary areas of interest. Are there areas of the world that you feel are largely ignored by the developed world? Do you think the media does a good job of covering difficult areas?
Oh, well, to answer the last part of the question first, no, I think the media does a terrible job. In most instances, the media does a terrible job of everything in this country because it's corporately owned and has a kind of bias that suggests that certain things shouldn't be addressed. As far as the ignoring, we have a kind of... one of the things I always loved about MASH is it didn't talk down to the audience. And I think the media talks down to the audience in large part, and particularly the so-called news media. The electronic news is really geared to exploitive news, whatever can get them the highest ratings. The great ugliness about our news today was the day the decision was made to incorporate news coverage into the rating system. There was a time when it wasn't involved.
It was a public service.
Exactly, and that's what it should be. But once they became involved in getting ratings, And it's all about who's killed whom, who's raped whom, whose house is burned down, whose dog is lost, which blonde is lost in which part of the world, rather than what's really going on in the world. If you listen to the difference between the U.S. media news coverage and the BBC, for example, or to take the rather radical comparison to Al Jazeera, then you begin to get the idea that there's a very different perspective out there that ought to be available to us.
Okay, so why is it that, in your opinion, so many people buy this, I'm going to call it what it is, this myth that the media has a liberal bias when it's all owned by major corporations?
It's the same process by which people have come to believe that, and the old saw is better than government work, or if you want to have a problem, you got a problem now, think about what it would be like if you turned it over to the government. There is this anti-government sort of bias that has been passed down over time by the right wing because they don't want you to believe that the government does good things for people. And I think the same thing is true about they decided years ago that the media that was giving out information straightforwardly had a liberal bias. And they continue to beef that the media has a liberal bias when today we well know that the radio, for instance, is 90% conservative. But they continue to talk about the media's liberal bias.
Here's another question from the audience. Are you going to be telling your MASH story tonight?
I'm asked.
Hey, Mike, how about telling your MASH story?
If it's the MASH story that I think that I've told in a couple of different places, it's about a practical joke that was done on the set that I would love to tell you, but it takes a while.
There's no Reader's Digest version of this story?
No, there's not, unfortunately.
All right, we'll move along. We're short on time. Okay, and you talked about changing Hannity's mind about death penalty. Have you ever heard a rational, sensible argument that persuaded you of a conservative point of view?
Let's see. Yes, probably, but I can't think of it just now. No, somebody has to throw me. I consider myself rather conservative in certain areas, so I'm not. I don't have to be converted to certain conservative
Nobody's
points
dogmatic.
Of view. So, but I can't think of one. Sorry.
We'll come back to that one.
Yeah, then. Please.
Can you talk about your book of Mule and Man? Who did you meet? What did you learn from the people fighting for social justice in different parts of the country?
That it's a fight worth having and that we are winning. Social justice is an issue that has come to the fore of people's consciousness, and it's social justice in a lot of ways. It's not only ending the use of the death penalty and ending the war in Iraq and, in my view, ending the war in Afghanistan, but it's also about ending the war on drugs and separating out drug abuse as a health problem rather than a criminal justice problem. It's about emptying our prisons of about two-thirds of the people who don't belong there and finding alternatives to incarceration that will be more productive for the individual as well as for society. It's about meeting people's health needs. We've talked about that. It's about honoring the elderly and considering people who have gained in years some wisdom as worthwhile and not people that ought to be shuttled off to the pasture somewhere. There are so many issues that have gone by the boards. We've become a society that is far too willing to allow people to become invisible. And I think that the social justice community is working on making the invisible visible.
You know, I'm just thinking about something you just said about how the elderly are disregarded. In television, the demographic they want was 18 to 54.
That was, right? Yeah.
For 18, some. 18 to 54 is the prime demographic. I always wondered why that is, because the older people have all the money. Their kids are gone. They're out. Their houses they bought for $19 in 1947 is paid for. So why, you've spent a lot of time in network television. Do you know why that they disregard this entire demographic?
Somebody,
so silly.
Somebody told them that those are the people with the primary who do the primary buying. Since then, they've changed it much lower. So it's the teenagers who do the primary buying or the preteens.
Where are they getting the money? From us.
From us. Exactly right.
If you hadn't been an actor, what do you think you would have been?
I don't know. I would love to have been something in the helping professions. If I'd had the schooling, I would love to have been a psychologist or somebody who's trying to reach out to work with people who are in need.
Let's see. Do you have any intent to run for public office?
None whatsoever.
You wouldn't consider it?
No.
How about an appointment? To be like an ambassador
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, sure. What I'd love to be, I mean, I would be a senator if somebody, you know, a senator, forgive the notion, passed away and the governor said, I would like you to run for, to fill that seat for a certain period of time. And I could do that with a declaration that I would not run for re-election, and then I could do and say some things that needed to be done and said on the floor of the Senate. That would be thrilling, but I have no interest in running for office.
Well, it's funny because what you did in Mule and Man is really a campaign. Essentially, you stumped 8,000 miles.
But I was campaigning not for me. I was campaigning for a lot of other people.
Okay. Here's a question about I don't know if I call him a colleague or not. How do you feel about the job that Governor Schwarzenegger is doing? Do I call him a colleague?
No, I wouldn't call him a colleague. I think he's every bit as good a governor as he was an actor.
I'll take damning with faint praise for 100, please.
You know, I have to say, and I will give credit to him, every time somebody asks me about Governor Schwarzenegger, I think of Red Buttons, the late Red Buttons, who said of the man, he doesn't know if harass is one word or two.
All right. Well, let me ask you that: if you were in his chair right now with the budget mess that we're in, and the state's going to be handing out IOUs, they say now in 2 weeks, how would you balance the budget? Because his proposals are primarily balancing the budget on the backs of the poor and of children.
Indeed. First of all, if you simply eliminated the death system, you would save $135 million every year. If you eliminate the death system and all the trappings around it, you would earn this country, this state, forgive me, $1 billion within 5 years. So that's just one small way in which we could keep food in the mouths of poor children and not be killing people.
Okay. We're $24 billion short.
So yes, okay, I'm still working on it. We could release the people who are nonviolent criminals, nonviolent offenders that are in our prisons, and we could lower the budget, therefore, that we pay for all the money that we pay to maintain these people in lockup. And that would save us a huge amount of money. The other thing I would do is go back to the legislature and say, do your damn job and get us a budget, and you get it by raising taxes if necessary, and you get it by changing the requirement that was imposed by Proposition 13 here, that you can't pass a budget without a two-thirds vote in both houses of the legislature. I will tell you, if you were able to pass a budget by a simple majority, we'd have had a budget, and it would have cost us some dough. But those of us who have the money to pay in terms of paying our taxes, knowing that it was going to go to save the welfare system in this state, would pay it, and they'd pay it happily.
What was it that you called San Quentin in the other book?
A turd on San Francisco Bay.
Okay. Well, the governor's talking about selling that turd. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, but he's talking about spending $400 million to build a new death row somewhere else.
All right, here's another question from the audience. You were so involved in the causes you champion. Do you still find time for acting, writing, or directing?
Yeah, oh, sure. I mean, jobs come up, and I'm happy to do them when they're interesting. I do, you know, shows on television or movies and parts in movies. But I've gained a few years since Mahesh went off the air, so I fit into parts that I didn't fit into before and don't fit into the parts I did fit into before, so we have to make some adjustments.
You look the same. You look exactly the same.
Thank you very much.
You've got a really old portrait in your attic someplace at home. You look great.
Thank you.
I will tell you the one I didn't understand when we needed Desperate Housewives. You were much, much too young to be playing the father of the actor.
I love hearing you say that. Thank you.
Did you see him in Desperate Housewives? Did we see it?
I played a real nasty guy on Desperate Housewives. It was great fun. I love, you know, playing a villain is really where the juice is. It's really, really the fun part.
Let's see. Obama's come in office with a new perspective. Oh, I asked this question already. Sorry. If it's okay to prove innocence based on new technology, would it not be fair to overturn the protection of double jeopardy and to count a previously cleared innocent person based on new technology? In other words, somebody that was acquitted, and then later on they find out through technology that didn't exist at the time that they did it, should double jeopardy go out the window?
Yeah, no, I think to do away with double jeopardy would put too much power in the hands of the prosecution, and also do real damage to some of the fundamental principles and fundamental values and fundamental rights in this country.
San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, former eBay CEO Meg Whitman, and Insurance Commissioner Steve Poizner have all announced their candidacy for California governor. Is there anyone that you wish would also step up to the plate, and why?
Gee, I don't have a particular candidate for governor. I don't have anybody that I would urgently suggest. If Bill Moyers were in California, I might suggest him. I'm sure there are some very good people out there that just aren't doing it because they don't have the dough or don't want to go around asking people for money. Don't forget Jerry Brown. I would never forget Jerry Brown.
Like he'd let you.
I was on Jerry Brown's radio show after he was governor, in which we talked and agreed for 2 hours about the inappropriateness of the use of the death penalty. Jerry Brown is today the attorney general of this state, and they are condemning people to death with some regularity and defending death sentences. So I'm not quite sure what Jerry Brown stands for.
I was trying to get Proposition 8 overturned.
If he's willing to try to get Proposition 8 overturned, good for him.
President Obama was incredibly successful using social media to mobilize the masses. Do you Twitter or Facebook, and what do you think about the new technology?
I'm sort of terribly confused by the new technology. I have no idea what Twittering is, and it sounds really stupid. I have a Facebook page because my daughter told me that I should have one because they would talk about the book on it, and she said she would run it for me, and she hasn't. So it's talking about your face hanging out there.
You get what you pay for.
Yeah.
let's see, another death penalty question. You've been a lifelong opponent of the death penalty and a strong proponent of prison reform. Can you explain how you got involved with these two issues and why you are so passionate about them?
Well, I've always thought the death penalty made no sense, but in the 60s I was involved with a halfway house organization that dealt with people who were drug addicts and alcoholics and people out of prisons and mental institutions, and when I became one of what they called the responsible members of the group, we went into prisons and talked to people in there about coming out and not going back to the circumstances that they lived in that led them into the acts that they had committed that got them in trouble in the first place. And you see the spiritlessness in a prison. You see the anti-human sort of behavior of the custodial people there. You see the real ugliness of the lives that have led so many people into that situation. And it just felt to me like there was something terribly, terribly wrong with the way we did so-called corrections in this country. And then when I was doing MASH, a minister contacted me and said, you know, the Supreme Court has renewed the 1976, it renewed the use of the death penalty, and we're going to have a bloodbath in this country, and I know you're opposed to it, or I've read that you're opposed to it. Would you join me in a campaign to end it? And I said yes, and went down with him to Tennessee and visited my first death row. And I will confess, going in, I had some trepidation. I thought, I'm going to see snarling, fang-toothed, child-eating monsters. And what I saw were ignorant men, mostly black, significantly ignorant, illiterate in some instances, people who had just horrific lives. And I thought, you know, there's got to be a better way than this to deal with this situation. And Everything I've found out about the death system ever since then just makes me, I'm not a hater, but it makes me hate what it does to us as a people to have a system that allows us to take lives.
Now, you're a big proponent of rehabilitation, and the late 70s, the state of California voted that we wanted prisons to be about punishment as opposed to rehabilitation?
I think that's some of the so-called leadership that's moved people in that direction over time. A word about rehabilitation. One of the former drug addicts who was running the program I just talked about.
The House, yes.
He said, and I'll never forget it, somebody used the word rehabilitation, and he said, rehabilitation bullshit. Most of these people have never been habilitated in the first place. And, that's the problem when you look at it.
All right. So what about the argument that people who, even if they were not the monsters that we believe them to have been when they were incarcerated, since there is no rehabilitation, they're let out, they're worse than in a lot of cases, they learn how to be better criminals, and they're worse than they were when they were initially incarcerated.
Yeah.
What about the argument that rehabilitation can't possibly work because that's what the outcome is, and these people can't be rehabilitated once they're out? That's why the rate of recidivism is so high.
That's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Isn't
if you take away the rehabilitation programs or the habilitation programs, and then you condemn people for being worse when they get out than they were when they went in, and you've left them in a maintenance situation that's really a criminal factory, how can you expect otherwise? If we would expend some monies, as they do in other countries, and as some places in our own country have been known to do, to actually teach people their value. I was in San Quentin 2 weeks ago with a couple of women who run a literacy program. And some of it's being run. It's what they call peer teaching, peer counseling, where they teach people about how to read and write, and then some of the cons teach other cons how to read and write, and they then supervise. And you see these people who are so grateful for simply having somebody pay enough attention to them to help them understand what the letters mean. Then you just begin to understand what people are capable of doing. The place I was in, the halfway house that I was part of, I saw people transform their lives. And I believe in the capacity for people to transform their lives. So all we have to do is recognize the fundamental value of human beings, even those who behave monstrously under certain circumstances, and then find a way to put them in a situation where they can learn to do it better, learn to do the right thing rather than the wrong thing. Except in the cases where people are just so broken that they have to be maintained in an incarcerated posture, it seems to me we could be creating productive citizens rather than simply warehousing people and shipping them out when we have to ship them out to go back to the mean streets and do it again.
We've just got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to just do a quick shift to international affairs. The president has taken a lot of criticism from the right for not being forceful enough in his response to the protests in Iran and the election. And curiously, George Bush hasn't said a lot about the election either, being perhaps illegitimate. Do you believe that his response has been appropriate?
Yes, I think he's been quite appropriate. First of all, I think he's been somewhat guarded in his response to it. I think today he condemned the brutality, which is appropriate, and he also raised questions about not the legitimacy of the election itself, but the process by which the government has dealt with the people post-election. I think that's the job of the president. He's got to use his bully pulpit in ways that are both beneficial to us as a world leader, and meaningful in terms of recognizing the people in Iran who are acting out their frustration at the way in which this election was handled. I don't know how fair or unfair the election in Iran was, and I think it's wrong for us to prejudge it, and I think it would be wrong for him to prejudge it as well.
So the criticism is unfair, then?
The criticism of him is certainly unfair, yeah, in my view.
All right. Yeah. One other thing you mentioned, I just took a shot at George Bush, and I take that back. But in your book, though, you did the same thing. Actually, you called him President Stupid, and then you said, "Well, I don't really mean that." So tell me exactly what your assessment is of his intellect. You don't get to be the president of the United States if you're stupid.
No, you don't. And it was said in anger. And I say things in anger sometimes that I regret. And I did apologize in the book. I really don't think the man is stupid. I think he's a narcissist. I think he's somebody who only cares about what serves him. And I think his behavior in the presidency was disgusting. I thought it was inappropriate in just about every aspect. Not doing the honor to the fallen service people who came back from the war that he created illegally, in my view, of allowing their photographs of the coffins to be done, not showing up at their services for them, demonstrating an utter contempt for the people who opposed the war, actually demonstrating an utter contempt for the people who, on some levels, the people who fought the war, but certainly the people on the other side of it. I find the 8 years that Cheney and Bush ruled this country to be one of the great periods of American degradation, and I'm angry about it. I really think that it's something that that requires redress in so many ways, not only to the international community, but to the people of the United States.
Did you ever have cause to meet him when he was the governor of Texas, because they were leading the country in executions, like 152 or something he presided over?
He presided over 152 executions. At the time, he was the governor who presided over more executions than any other. Rick Perry, however, since he's taken over the position, now has outdone George Bush.
What's the current number?
The current number of executions overall?
In Texas.
Oh, in Texas, it's over, I think they've done over 400 in the last, since executions were reestablished by the Supreme Court. There have been about 1,100 executions, so 400 of them have been in Texas.
I just got to note that this final question, since we're talking about Texas, the governor is talking about Texas perhaps seceding from the Union. Should we stop them? Or should we say, don't let the Mason-Dixon line hit you in the butt on the way out the door?
I wouldn't argue with your position at all. No, there's some great folks in Texas. The Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Very courageous people, and I've been down there. Charles, what was his name? Chuck Rosenthal was the DA of Harris County, Texas, which was the buckle on the death belt, was responsible for more death penalty prosecutions and more executions than any other. And poor old Chuck had, as a result of a lawsuit that required that his emails were made public, he was shown to be a racist, a misogynist, and somebody who made jokes about raping women. And he was thrown out of office as a result of it. So you see, this business of being tough on crime sometimes goes hand in hand with being a real dog.
And on that note, the book is of Mule and Man, and it is, as they say, a good read. Congratulations on it, and a pleasure to talk with you. Mike Farrell, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
I hope you've all enjoyed the program tonight, brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley and Kepler's Bookstore. Once again, we'd like to thank Mike Farrell for participating and our moderator, Brian Copeland. All of this wonderful audience here in Palo Alto and all of the listeners that will be joining us on the radio. And now, the meeting of this Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley is adjourned.